Welcome back to the High Impact Physician Podcast. Today's episode, Sandy is talking with Dr. Lyle Berkowitz, who is a physician executive and entrepreneur who wears a bunch of different hats. He's had a very unique career journey that I hope each of you can take something helpful away from. On this episode, it's a two-part episode. On the first part, Sandy and Lyle are discussing how to try new career moves without getting stuck as a physician. They're also talking about the reasons physician startups can fail and the path to building a more successful company as a doc. They're also talking about the hardest parts of moving into a clinical executive role, especially things that aren't talked about. And in the second part of this episode, they're talking a little bit more about design thinking and some really practical examples of how Lyle's seen that implemented successfully, as well as some methods to simplify, automate, and delegate clinical workflows and some other things. So I really hope you guys enjoy this episode. Stay tuned for part two, which will come later in the episode.
Lyle, welcome to the show. I'm excited to have you here. And I think one of the reasons I'm so excited is you have this incredible combination of knowledge, expertise, and experience. So let's kick off by having you tell us a bit about you and how you got to where you are.
Sure. So I'm an internal medicine primary care physician. My undergrad was biomedical engineering. And very early in my career, I found this intersection of IT, computers, healthcare, problem solving from an engineering perspective, and have always made it part of my career. And then along the way, fortunately, came into a variety of situations that I was able to help with, from being a primary care physician for over 20 years and a great medical center at Northwestern Medicine in Chicago, to being a physician executive with Northwestern, both in the informatics and innovation space, to being in the business world. I've been chief medical officer for several companies. I founded companies, been on the boards of companies. So I've been able to sort of combine my clinical knowledge, my executive business knowledge, and my technical knowledge to be sort of a translator amongst everybody and perhaps a jack of all trades, so to speak, so I can ideally see all the edges and ideally surround myself with people who are really good in each of those categories.
Okay, I can imagine writing a poem and the title of the poem is Seeing the Edges. That is so good. That's awesome. So as I'm listening to you and just how incredibly unique your career path has been, I'm struck by the way you said the word intersection. You found this way to acknowledge different passions, different interests you have, to really support a really unusual career path. At the same time, I know there's a number of physicians out there that feel really trapped in whatever current role they have, whatever work they're doing. What supported you to try new things and not get stuck?
I've been lucky in a couple of ways. One, early in my career, I just sort of felt like I could take some risks and follow my heart in a variety of ways and that things would work out, sort of just a positive spirit. But I think when I look at it, it's a combination of having really good mentors and leaders who are willing to let me do some of those things and take those chances, with the knowledge that the more I learned outside of traditional healthcare and being a doctor, the more I could bring and be of value in the organization where I was. With that said, when I have lectured medical students in the past, I'll often tell them, being a doctor is amazing, but if you have other interests, see how you can combine those. I actually had a lot of interest in entertainment industry. My father had been a doctor to many of the movies and TV shows. I grew up being an extra in movies, et cetera. So I always liked that. So I combined that with my clinical career, and I actually took care of many of the movies and TV shows in Chicago. And yeah, it was extra work, but it was just fun. It made things more fun. I tell the med students, look, if you like dance and ballet, make that part of your career. If you like flying airplanes, figure out a way to become an expert in something to do with pilots and flying, et cetera. There's no reason you have to abandon some of your other loves just because you're in medicine.
So good. I can hear the creativity, that positive spirit. If you were to bundle that up into some advice for a physician who real time is feeling stuck, overwhelmed, unhappy right now, what advice would you give him or her?
Well, I think you got to step back and figure out the intersection of what you're good at, what makes you happy, and what you have to earn. And if you really do feel burned on, stuck, it is time to step back. And I would not give up your day job, but maybe advise a startup of interest. There are a lot of young kids out there who have some amazing ideas, and they could really use a physician mentor to navigate the healthcare system. It may not mean a lot of money. It may be a bit of time, but it will energize you and make you feel better and or become an expert, particularly for primary care doctors who truly are jack of all trades. Sometimes it is fun to get really down and involved with something. Write a paper with a med student about an interesting patient you had. I did that once and found it really fulfilling, actually. Wound up writing on a very small, sort of unlikely little issue called cyclic vomiting syndrome, because I had one patient who had it and we did some interesting things with him. But there are lots of different ways where you can help, mentor, and just add on to your day job in ways that sort of re-energize and revitalize you.
Love it. I love how practical that is and how tactical that is to really get real, step back, check out what you're good at, what you like. It really lends me to this next set of questions around entrepreneurialism. Love the way you're saying, if you've got some good ideas, start exploring, maybe partner with someone else who has some good ideas. As you think about some of the startups you've been a part of or other ones you've observed, let's just go to the dark side first. What are some of the biggest reasons you've seen new businesses fail?
Well, I'll tell you, I see a lot when I was director of innovation at Northwestern. You know, I would review a lot. And I'd always start with saying, tell me how your business model makes sense, how it aligns three things. Who uses your tool? Who pays for your tool? And who benefits financially from your tool? And it was remarkable how often you'd have a young, smart entrepreneur say, oh, this is something that just takes a doctor an extra minute of time and it only costs $1,000 a year. I'm like, okay, how does it help? Oh, it makes the patient experience better and it saves money for the healthcare system. So for the insurance company, I go, so you're expecting a doctor to pay money to spend more time so they can save money for someone else. I go, it just, the world doesn't work that way. If it's a value-based system, maybe, but you've got to really figure out how those three things combine. Second, and I've been involved with a lot of companies, and I see this over and over again, every type of startup, is you've got to focus. What happens is start out focused, but then they see too much and they try and do too much. They lose that focus and they get over their skis. They spend too much time and money on things that are not core to their business, and then they never really take off. And then third is the bad apple. You know, you have bad executives, bad people who endorse bad culture, and you might put up with them because they're good at sales or something. But if you're leading or involved in a company, making sure you've got a great culture is what's going to keep it moving long term.
Okay. I'm feeling particular empathy for that second one you brought up about focus. I think about when we have our morning huddles with our team, I tend to spark a lot of ideas. And personally, how I'll have an idea I think is so brilliant. And my team takes us right back to the dashboard to say, so where does this fit in with our pillars? How does this add value to others, not you, Sandy? So I'm really feeling empathy for the focus.
Yeah, I'll add, I know what you mean. I'll often tell my teams, I'll tell them ahead of time, look, I'm creative. I have a lot of ideas. They're not all winners. They're not all good ideas. Make sure you hold me accountable. You got to be smarter than me in figuring out which are the good ones. But I'll keep coming up with new ones for you.
We've got some code words. Even my husband has a code word, and his code word is really okay. So if I say something I think is brilliant, we've kind of trained each other not to like slap it down. He'll listen to the whole thing and then say, really? Okay. And he'll give me a wink. And that's when I know this is like one of the not good ideas. But it sure feels good to talk through.
Some of the best ideas start out as the craziest idea you can imagine.
You mean like launching an entire consulting company that purely coaches physicians?
Yep, all the above.
So talk to us a little bit more for listeners who are interested in something around entrepreneurship, trying out one of their good ideas. What's some concrete advice you would give them?
You know, I read an article recently that I thought was great advice, and that was really solve a very specific problem. Think about a very specific problem. The author in this case talked about helping a family with two or more children who lives in San Francisco find the best hotel in London. And that's a super specific problem, but solve that problem and then grow from there. So in the healthcare field, you can imagine there are a lot of doctors who can solve something very small and then let it expand. Sometimes we talk about create a point solution and expand it into a platform, but don't try to boil the ocean all at once, particularly if you're a small entrepreneur. And the second, for docs, do not leave your day job. Doctors are not the best business people, particularly doctors who've been practicing for many years. It's a combination of, or you aren't steeped in necessarily business knowledge or the newest technology. And quite honestly, you're used to getting your way. Doctors are used to being the bosses that no one challenges, and that's not how the business world works. But doctors can be unbelievably valuable in starting and helping businesses, but it's rare to find a doctor who really can and should be doing that full time. And particularly if you've been practicing for many years, there's so many opportunities to do it part time.
Okay, I feel like I'm right now just ignoring the listeners. I'm having this conversation with you and they're speaking straight to me, because even when we launched our company, I thought since I had a bachelor's degree in business, a master's degree, blah, blah, I could get this going on my own. And what I soon discovered is I love the niche of doing the work, though I needed to build a team to build the business. And I did not realize how distinctly different that was. And it was actually at that point that we had our first person come on who actually set up the operations, set up the processes, automated and put on a tech platform. And that's when our business started to grow. I was not aware of how critical that is.
Yeah, I think most small businesses in particular, when I started, I'll talk about later, Health Function, it started with myself as sort of the vision and strategy and networking person. But what I found was two young guys who were willing to devote themselves full time. Both of them were just out of college, getting their PhDs, one in design thinking, the other in engineering. And they both had a fair amount of business sense because they had been doing consulting as part of their ways to get through college. And we learned a lot along the way. We also surrounded ourselves with some good people on our board and hired really smart people as well.
So good. I think one of the themes is you can always do well when you bring an engineer on the team. Just got great ways of thinking through processes and critical thinking. And maybe I'm biased because we have an engineer on our team too. So I want to get into that around design thinking, though I want to set us up for that a bit. You've tapped into some of your work as a physician leader, moving from being primary clinical with some leadership experience and then moving into an 80-20 where you're primarily leadership. Talk to us a bit about maybe what was a pain point or the hardest part of your journey as you progressed into that bigger leadership role.
The higher up you get, the more visible you get, and the more time you have to spend just getting buy-in from everybody. It was, in many ways, easier for me to enact change and innovation when I was a little lower down and could just move ahead and have executive cover, maybe worked on smaller projects that eventually could spread. The higher up you get, the bigger impact you can have, but it goes slower and a lot more of your time is spent on calls and emails and meetings and PowerPoints. And you know, for someone who likes to be creative and innovate, for me personally, that was the hardest part.
Awesome. So maybe staying with that, what do you know now that you wish you had known then early in your leadership career?
Something I learned, I don't know, maybe midway through or so, it should be obvious that to get senior executive buy-in, align with executive goals. If you're in a large matrix organization, your VPs, particularly non-physician VPs, they've got goals that are their measured for the year and that will reflect their bonuses. So if you go to them with a project that has nothing to do with any of their goals, as good as that project sounds, don't expect to get a lot of enthusiasm. But if you go to them with a project that helps them meet their goals, they become very aligned. And I learned a bit about trial and error on that and eventually figured out the more I can attune and align with their goals, the better. And that certainly became an easier way to move things forward.
So as you're talking through that, attune and align to their goals, sounding like influence is one really important skill. What are three, four, five other skills that you see highly effective physician leaders having?
Well, certainly communication. With that sort of that translation I mentioned, so because you're going to have to communicate to multiple parties, your physicians, and really understanding how to get a physician adoption, and at the same time understanding where it all fits in the business world and how it works in the technology world. So being able to communicate and translate amongst all of those becomes really important. And then the second thing, of course, is the business side, is understanding everything from business models to budgets. The more you understand and can talk and explain what you want to do with respect to how hits the bottom line, the more likely you can move ahead and succeed. I'll add in another sort of less tangible skill is sometimes act like a child. What does that mean? It means be open to exploring the world, trying new things, learning how to fail, particularly if you want to really change things. The status quo is there for a reason. I often find that large health systems are victims of their own success, but they do need people internally who will question the status quo to try and do things differently. And part of that's, it means failure. We often talk about fail fast, fail cheap, and fail often. But as a doctor, you're taught to never fail. So that is a skill and something you have to accept.
Okay, I think you're developing a lot of Lyle-isms. So this whole notion that highly effective physicians are translators, they understand business models, they're childlike, and fail fast, cheap, and often is a whole new algorithm, a whole new way to think of leadership. And it sounds like a big invitation.
Yes, but you have to be careful and be okay with arrows in your back and be strong. I mean, this is certainly more in the innovator side of leadership. And there are going to be people who support and love you, and you have to make sure you've got good executive support. And you have to recognize that you won't please all the people all the time. And the people who are happy with the status quo will not be happy. And that includes everyone from clinicians to technology folks to business folks. And you have to have a strong spine and ideally a good mentor group. I've been very fortunate. I've been involved in groups like the Innovation Learning Network, which is a nonprofit of innovators from across the nation. And when we get together, you know, we do share our stories of how hard it can be sometimes, but so satisfying in the end.
Wow. I think that's really important, especially during this time of this COVID pandemic, about how to be anchored and how to be really expansive. Really, how to be attuned and aligned with what is and how to have that agility and creativity. What are some other skills you'd recommend to physicians who really want to be part of the future of healthcare?
This is where making sure you understand what's going on across the world and particularly in other industries becomes important. I love being able to read books, watch TED Talks, go to conferences where I can learn things that are outside of the typical healthcare system. Quite honestly, you know, I look at what does banking do? What does Walt Disney World do? What do the startups that have nothing to do with healthcare do? And how do we bring that into healthcare? How do we translate that sometime? I mean, there are certainly some obvious analogies. Most recently, I look at Blockbuster and Netflix, and you read that story. And I remember being at a conference where they had the founders of Netflix talking about how they were trying to disrupt. They were told by Blockbuster, you're crazy. You guys aren't going to go anywhere. We're going to destroy you. People want to come into our stores. They want to touch the merchandise, talk to people in person. They didn't realize, Blockbuster, that that wasn't the problem that they were trying to solve. People wanted media. They wanted as quick and easy and fast and cheap as possible. And Netflix eventually delivered it to them. And I think we're seeing the same thing in the lines of care, from bricks and mortar to telehealth. People love it. Patients love it. Doctors are being actually surprisingly very happy with it. Needed a pandemic to get us there, but it's not going to change and go back to what it was. People aren't going to accept coming into the offices as routine care anymore, just like they don't go to the bank or the travel agent or to the Blockbuster stores that don't exist anymore.
I'm so intrigued how you're able to zoom out and really normalize what's going on now in healthcare. So rather than getting hooked into the chaos and the turbulence, I love the way you zoomed out to say, let's look at what happens with entertainment, with other industries. And it really is almost relaxing a bit to think that we're not as isolated. We really are part of creating the future, and we can watch how other industries have succeeded and failed. So I think what I would love to do here is I want to jump into a lot of work you're doing as a national thought leader, a consultant, talking about the future of healthcare. I'm also looking at the clock, and I'm wondering if you'd be open to maybe offering some closing comments here around your work as an entrepreneur and physician leadership guru or expert or experience. And then let's schedule another time to talk about some of your other experiences. How does that sound?
Sure. I'll just suggest to my fellow doctors that we need more doctors involved in leadership at your office level, medical group level, health system level, in startups, etc. I mean, we have core competency and knowledge that's extremely important. It's not something that you necessarily have to do full time, but you know, as doctors, volunteer for a committee or again, help a startup become an expert in something that is very small that no one else may be an expert in. There are so many different ways that physicians can do this, and it's important to help change healthcare. And it's important, I think, for the sanity of many healthcare providers and physicians to continue to feel happy and satisfied in balancing their lives appropriately. So I am always a fan of seeing when there's a physician involved with something. But just remember, your case, whoever you are, whatever your history is an N of one. And so you've got to be really open and empathetic to representing a lot of doctors, because when you are in that position of leadership, you do need to represent a long history of doctors that span from many different specialties, many different settings, etc. And so empathize, listen, talk to them. The cool thing is most doctors will tell you very quickly what their pain points are and what they love about something, what they want changed. And your job is to help translate that and assimilate as much as possible to help direct whatever company, health system, technology, et cetera, you're working with.
I love the way you reframe it, that it really is about supporting physicians to tap more into who they are and what pulls them forward, what gives them energy, and how that can be aligned with leadership, whatever that means to them. Tell us just another closing thought here, a bit about, you have a book. Tell us a bit about your book, your company, and how people can get a hold of you.
I now am a CEO of my own consulting company, Backline Healthcare Consulting. Mostly do executive advisory work for a variety of companies, some startups, some larger, and health systems around how to be more innovative, particularly with digital health, particularly around the future of reimagining primary care. I'm easily found at www.drlyle.com, drlyle.com. I did write a book a couple of years ago called Innovation with Information Technologies in Healthcare. And this is a case studies, almost 30 case studies, that look at everything from electronic medical records to telehealth to the gaming industry intersecting with healthcare, and how doctors, just day-to-day doctors and leaders, were able to do something innovative in their own healthcare systems. And the book provides really almost like a cookbook of how they were able to do it and gives you ideas of how you might be able to apply that same thinking into your own system. The website for the book is www.thehealingedge.org. It's on Amazon, etc. And then lastly, I'm on the boards of two healthcare companies, HealthThinks, which does a workflow automation, clinical automation tools to help take the burden off of doctors by automating routine workflows and delegating them to staff. We save about a million minutes a week for physicians across the nation. And OneView Healthcare, which is a company that develops software to make the experience and efficiency for doctors and nurses, and most particularly patients, better in a hospital room.
Boy, I so highly recommend to folks to reach out to you. You've got such a practical, tactical way of reimagining healthcare for the organizations, for teams, providers, and for the patient. Have really enjoyed this conversation. I'm looking forward to scheduling another conversation, because we haven't even tapped into your expertise with design thinking and the future of healthcare. So thanks so much for your time today. I want to highly recommend your book, your services, and look forward to connecting again soon.
All right, let's jump into part two right now. Sandy and Lyle are going to be talking about why healthcare needs to understand design thinking. They're going to get into some really practical examples of people that have used it well. They're also talking about the power of gathering insights from the front lines when you're trying to solve problems, as well as some methods to simplify, automate, and delegate clinical workflows, and how to use financial incentives, artificial intelligence, and telehealth to scale projects quickly. Hope you get something awesome out of this episode.
So one of my observations of your work is you approach a lot of things differently. And it seems to me you have an innate way of working with design thinking, human-centered design. Talk to us a little bit about what design thinking is, and maybe even more specifically, how it can be relevant to healthcare.
Sure. I appreciate it. I think I do have that different mindset, which I've had all my life. My mom there's a Yiddish term for it, but basically it's he wants to know from whence it came. And I would always take things apart and try and understand it. There's good and bad in a world of healthcare where people are used to and want things to be consistent and evidence-based. It's not always a good thing to be the guy who questions, why are we doing it that way? Could we do it better? But let's talk about design thinking. And this is a system of problem solving and designing that's based on a deep interest in developing an understanding of the people involved in the problem that you're trying to solve. Another way to look at it is it's an iterative process that starts with understanding, again, the needs of the end user, challenging assumptions about the status quo, and redefining what problem you're trying to solve, and then using all that to find alternative solutions that aren't apparent on the initial level of understanding, and then starting this test cycle, seeing what works, seeing what makes sense, and as we discussed last time, failing fast, failing cheap, failing often.
So good. As you're speaking through this, I'm having a flashback because our team likes to work with design thinking. I didn't know about it. We have engineers on our team. And I will tell you, it is a hard muscle to build. I still catch myself wanting to sit in the office or go to the whiteboard and draw these brilliant ideas in my own space. And yet my team reminds me, as you said, it's an iterative process and it starts by connecting to the end user. I think that's such a key point. That is easy to say, though, until you get your own iterations of understanding the power, you can forget how critical that is to design thinking. I appreciate you reminding me here and now, real time.
Yeah, there's a lot of top down in healthcare. I just want to emphasize, like bottom up, frontline workers. When I consult to organizations, it's often easy. I just go to the frontline workers, the doctors and the nurses and the patients, and say, what's going on? What do you love about what you do? What would you change about what you do? I just take notes and I go back, and often I don't even have to do a lot of brainstorming. The frontline workers sort of know what has to be done, and I can help push to operationalize it.
Okay, I'm having a total burst of brilliance right now. I'm laughing because I just had a flashback. I used to work at Kinko's Copies 30 years ago and worked as a regional manager. And I forgot about this, but the way I worked was I'd fly around to the stores. I'd take our part-timers out to lunch and say, talk to me. What's working? What do you need? And I remember the Montana region. They said, our customers don't like pastel blue. They want lunar blue. And I don't know why or how, but our region got number one in terms of a couple of different metrics they were tracking. And I couldn't figure it out at the time. I was having this imposter syndrome. But as you talk about the power of going to the front lines, listening, I love that as leaders, we don't have to do the work. It's really harvesting and harnessing the insights and the knowledge at the front line. What a great example.
Yeah, listening, watching what they do. I can tell you a couple of stories about that. And it's also when I hire a new person in the office or in any organization I'm in, that I sit down and the first thing I do is have a talk with them and say, you are now the most valuable person in this organization because you have fresh eyes. You're going to see stuff that does not make sense, and you have to come and let me know what that is. Just because you're a new guy doesn't mean you shouldn't ask a question. In fact, before you get used to everything, fill us in, because you are now the freshest eyes in the organization, and I want you to bring up why. I go, the worst I'll tell you is this is why we did it, and you'll understand. The best is I may say, oh, I never really thought about that. Yeah, you're right. We probably could do that better.
Okay, that has got to be one of the most radically refreshing ways to onboard someone. What a welcome way to bring people on board. That's great. Okay, so you mentioned you started to go down the path of talking about some scenarios or examples of how you've seen people apply design thinking. Talk to us a little bit about some of those scenarios and what the impact or the results were.
And maybe we'll talk later. I mentioned the book last time, which is Innovation with Information Technologies in Healthcare, and we have a whole bunch of these stories. One of the stories, one of my favorite stories, is from Kaiser. Their design team was tasked with figuring out how to decrease medication errors at the bedside in the hospital. And they went in and just started observing and talking to the nurses. And what they found was that there would be a nurse who was charged with distributing medications for the floor, and that nurse often would get interrupted in her job while she was trying to assemble the meds. People would come up to her and say, room six, they need something, this, that. And just by observing, not even talking, then they eventually talked more and understood that the problem was this nurse charged with this really important duty of setting up all the medications was being constantly interrupted, which is not good for being. And so they actually created a very simple solution where they gave that nurse a vest, a red vest, and that just meant, do not talk to me. You are not allowed to talk to me at all. I am busy doing something. It's really important, so unless it's an emergency. And the result was a significant decrease in medication errors because they just recognized the importance. I mean, super simple, right? Didn't involve any fancy technology, tools, or expensive equipment. And yet they made a really nice breakthrough. I have one more to tell you about as well. So I was inspired at the Innovation Learning Network, this nonprofit group I'm associated with that teaches us about design thinking and methodologies. We did a course on video ethnography. So ethnography is going and talking to people. Video ethnography is where you actually videotape it. The idea is that you don't have to talk to a lot of people. You can talk to 5 to 8 people and get a really good sense of a problem. And so a problem that I wanted to solve at Northwestern was that why we had patients with diabetes who were poorly controlled and is measured by a test called the hemoglobin A1C that was over 9. Hemoglobin A1C in a diabetic is supposed to be under 7. Between 7 and 8 is high. Over 8 is pretty high. Over 9 is really high. There's no reason that anyone should have that number. There's plenty of medications that can be used to treat them. So it implies that they're just not taking the medication. So we identified about 8 patients with a hemoglobin A1C over 9 for an extended period. We said, we want to come out to your house and interview you. It'll be a team of an interviewer who's using standard questions, someone who's going to videotape it, someone who's going to take notes, and someone who's going to take pictures. And I actually went out as a photographer at one point to go and see how this worked. What we found was a lot of our assumptions were smashed. We assumed people didn't understand their diabetes, and if they understood diabetes, they would take their medicine. They understood the concept of diabetes. We'd ask them, explain diabetes, and they would explain it to us. We asked, yes, your glucose is high. What are the complications? You can lose your kidney, your eyesight, et cetera. They understood that. What they didn't understand was whether they had diabetes because they felt fine. Oh, my doctor overreacts. I feel fine. I just forgot my medicine that day, et cetera. And they couldn't comprehend how bad their diabetes was because it, like a lot of diseases, was a silent disease. So we took all these and ran a big brainstorming session with 30 plus people from various parts of the organization. And we showed videos around certain themes. And in these videos, these people explained what I just said, how they understand diabetes, just not that applied to them. And what we came up with was this concept that we really have to make the description more personal to them. We shouldn't tell them how scary diabetes is. We simply have to get them to know their numbers. That number 9 is bad, the number 7 is good, green, yellow, red, et cetera. And we really put a big educational push on that and started seeing a turnaround of these patients willing to be more compliant and consistent with the medications. But it was an amazing project that just had us rethink how we try and talk and educate our diabetic patients.
Well, I think one of my favorite parts of that story is how you said the assumptions were smashed by using this approach that sounds very practical and tactical, yet also creative and innovative. And to think that that directly drove some amazing results makes that so powerful. What suggestions do you have for listeners who are interested in learning more about this design thinking?
You can literally Google healthcare design thinking and a lot of articles on it. The book I mentioned, Innovation with Information Technologies in Healthcare, certainly goes over a high level, but also gives specific examples in general, electronic medical records, telehealth, a variety of other areas. There are courses you could take. The Innovation Learning Network, ILN, is a organizational membership, meaning an organization can join. And then there's some very big companies who are in the space like IDEO. Gravity Tank is who I use for the diabetes project. And these companies sometimes put out books. IDEO, one of the most famous, the Kelly brothers, put out books on design thinking. But there's some really good articles you can read. A lot of it is common sense and but going through some of the methodologies to, and apply them in healthcare where they often haven't been applied.
Yeah, I think the IDEO website has some great stuff on methodologies. What I think is unique about your book is the case studies. Tell us the title once again and where people can get that.
So the title is Innovation with Information Technologies in Healthcare. Not a super sexy title, but we have a website, www.healingeggs.org. You can find it on Amazon. And you're right, the case studies are fantastic. We wound up getting submissions from around the world in a variety of different areas. And what we did was we asked each author to write in a consistent way about their innovation, starting with what prompted it, why they decided to do something different, what lessons they learned, what methodologies they used, and what the end results were. So there's a consistent theme to each story, and yet each story is a different way of describing it. And in one case, we actually had three organizations, each sort of do the same thing. They use their electronic medical record system to improve quality in a certain way, but they each did it somewhat differently in different EMR systems. And the important thing is, as you read these, the ideas don't need to copy exactly what they did, but you can be inspired directionally to understand, oh, wait a minute, I see what they did. I see how I could do that at my organization. And that's the key, is using these as a general cookbook. You don't have to follow the recipe specifically, as long as it inspires you on how you can do something new in your organization.
Okay, I think that's a new Lyleism. I've never heard that word, being directionally inspired. I love that distinction of how to get that burst of creativity while still having permission or encouragement to go out and apply it in a way that's relevant to your situation or a different situation. Great phrase, directionally inspired. And I'm excited to order that book myself. So thank you for more details on that. So another thing I know about your thought leadership, your consulting work, is you've developed a number of great philosophies. And one of them I heard you talk about is SAD. What is SAD?
Doctors, we love acronyms. So it's the best way for me to remember a variety of philosophies. SAD is the idea of how do we simplify, automate, and delegate routine, repeatable workflows to improve the life of both the doctor and the patient.
Okay, on so many levels, that just makes so much sense. So simplify, automate, delegate. Tell us a story about how a provider failed to do that and what the impact was on others.
I'll tell you the fail and succeed. One of the areas that I've always been intrigued about is, and I was an engineer by background, and I said, how come we do stuff that someone else should do? And in fact, part of it was I was one of those doctors who was on the cusp of using paper records and then using computerized records. And I noticed that in the paper world, we actually delegated a lot more things to our staff that in the computerized world wound up having to be done by us, at least in first pass. And so one of those areas was refills. You look at the refill process, you've got doctors who have been really good about delegating refills, you know, based on some protocols to their staff, sometimes centralizing, others who do it all themselves. And the ones who do it themselves, I mean, that's 30 minutes a day often. And they're not actually that consistent. I'd see doctors just refilling everybody for a year, others only refilling for a month. There was just no consistency in quality. So I helped start a company about 10 years ago called HealthFinch. And the idea around that was, how do we computerize those protocols and embed them into the electronic medical record system so that it could take the refill request, figure out how to deal with it and route it, either simplify and send it to the doctor when needed, but most of the time either automate or delegate it to a staff person based on appropriate protocol and let them know what to do. At the end of the day, we save doctors 20, 30 minutes a day. It adds up. With the number of doctors using it right now, we save approximately 1,000 minutes a week. To me, that is tremendous that we are able to give that back to doctors so they can focus on the things they should be focusing on. You can think about similar things that doctors wind up doing, administrative paperwork, et cetera, that really should be either, you know, simplified, computerized, automated, and or delegated to their staff.
Well, congratulations on that project. 1,000 minutes a week. I think that would stop anyone in our tracks and listen to that again. That's a really solid outcome. And I love that it integrates all three components, simplify, automate, and delegate. Great acronym. So funny because it's almost counterintuitive. It's got a shock factor to think of SAD, right?
Yeah, I often say we have to get SAD to make doctors happy. It helps people remember things. I tried to come up with an acronym that was closer to happy, but it just didn't work.
I think SAD is working because I've thought about it a lot since you first told me about it. Okay, so SAD is one funny acronym. I know you've got another one that strikes me as funny. There's one called FAT. What is FAT?
So I often say you have to get SAD and FAT to solve the healthcare system. So FAT is another acronym that involves particularly how to get adoption and move things forward in the organization. It's financial incentives, F, you know, alignment of financial incentives, use of AI, artificial intelligence, telehealth, and teamwork. These are the things that are needed to really succeed and scale in a sustainable way in a variety of projects. And when I think to myself, how are we going to solve healthcare? You know, just say, get SAD and FAT, which again, winds up being an easy and opposite way to remember, you know, the good things in healthcare.
Well, you caught my attention the first time you told me. The funny thing is now when someone mentions FAT or something, I think of these models. They're quite ordinary words. So tell us a story of how you've seen FAT applied and maybe insights that people got along the way.
Yeah, so you know, I was fortunate at Northwestern to be able to run a medical home project around population health, right? When we talk about the fact that we have a segment of our population who needs some extra support, usually around, you know, diabetes, cardiovascular health, metabolic type syndrome, and the doctors just don't have enough time to do everything. So what happened there was, first, we had a financial incentive. Blue Cross Blue Shield said, look, we will pay you X amount of money to more closely monitor and educate these patients. And we'll pay you an extra bonus if you can actually show that it makes a difference. So that F was really important. And then we figured out, okay, what are we going to do? Well, we hired some nurses. We used, I wouldn't call it quite AI, but certainly we used our computer, electronic medical record system, and our data warehouse to identify and risk stratify a variety of our patients. So I actually created a formula, an algorithm that we used to go in and risk stratify who amongst our Blue Cross Blue Shield patients had the highest risk for hospitalizations. And this was based on a combination of their problems, their meds, their past visits, etc. So now we have this chase list. So next, again, we create this team. So we have a nurse that's assigned to a couple of doctors. So we had one nurse for three of our doctors in my office, and we create a team where we'd meet once a week. We'd go down this list and talk about them. And then she, the nurse, would reach out to them on a regular basis, as I would. I would start out with an email or a secure message from me introducing the nurse, right? That teamwork was important, and that the nurse would be following up with that patient on a regular basis as their sort of concierge. Whatever you need, let's help out. The nurse would also be educated and use certain coaching techniques to help with lifestyle management, med compliance, etc. The result was, one, patients loved it. They felt very special. They felt they were really connected to us and were getting extra attention than they liked. And two, end of the day, our results showed that they had better compliance, less hospitalizations, etc. In the end, did the payer think it was worth it? It's a balance. They were continuing to evolve their system. It was a lot of work, but it used the essential principles that we've seen in population health work. I think it needed probably to be even more automated to make it cost efficient. But it was one of those early projects. This is, again, 10, 15 plus years ago that we're doing this. So it was one of the earlier projects that taught us that we could make a difference when we instilled all of these components.
What I'm appreciating about that is back to you, what you talked about in design thinking and the idea of rapid iterations. We don't have to have it perfect the first time through, but it's really following a framework, putting some of the essential principles in place, staying connected to the end users. How great that the patients walked away feeling really special and you got a foundation of really mapping out and applying these FAT principles. Okay, so what I'd love to do is have you tell us a bit more about your company, your book, how people can get a hold of you. And I'd love to schedule another time. You've got some great expertise and perspectives on the future of healthcare. So let's go that route. Tell us a bit about your company, your book, and how people can get a hold of you.
Well, I started a company many years ago when I was getting asked to do some consulting services. It's called Back Nine Healthcare Consulting. Started on the back nine of a golf course. And I do executive advisory work for companies, startups and large companies, as well as health systems who are looking to be more innovative in healthcare, particularly around digital health, telehealth, digital therapeutics, et cetera, and especially around reimagining the future of primary care, which is what I come out of as an internal medicine and primary care specialist. And that has been fun because it's really been a consistent theme I've had and experience I've learned. I've been involved in a lot of businesses over the years. So to be able to be a doctor who understands business and technology, I say I'm a little jack of all trades. I know enough of all to translate, and I love helping some startups avoid some of the pitfalls that I've seen, as well as some big companies learn how to think a little more innovatively. And I mentioned my book, Innovation with Information Technologies in Healthcare, at the website www.thehealingedge.org. My own website, www.drlyle.com, has a list of the type of things I do, everything from speeches to consulting on changing healthcare in general, and then links to LinkedIn. Please follow me on LinkedIn, as that's sort of my way to give my thoughts on the stories that are coming out every day.
So good. I think you have such an incredibly unique set of skills and experiences. As you said, doctor, business, and technology. And you said one of my favorite words, reimagining. So the idea of people reaching out to connect with you and help reimagine the future of primary care sounds very exciting. In closing, what else would you like to say?
Well, listen, this is a tough time for my colleagues. This is probably going to be one of the darkest times that we see for physicians. They are putting their lives in danger. They're having to dress up. And believe me, these masks and gowns, this is not comfortable. This is physically uncomfortable on top of the scariness of potentially dying. This is a really dark time for my doctor colleagues and for people thinking about going into medicine. I do think that there is a great future. I think that we're going to see over the next 5 to 10 years, a lot of automation, a lot of going back to doctors and providers being able to really focus on the patients as technology does some of the more mundane stuff, but it's going to be a bit of time. It's also satisfying to see so many providers, doctors, nurses, and others gain the appreciation they deserve, and also not just for their care, but for their leadership and the ideas that they have. They're the ones in the hospital while the administrators are maybe all sitting at home. The doctors and the providers, the nurses are the ones on the front lines doing the job that needs to be done and making decisions that need to be made quickly. So from that perspective, this is in many ways a satisfying time for doctors. At the same time, it's a scary and tough time. Finally, I just sort of mentioned healthcare has been on the edge for a while. It's been a runaway train. This whole experience has certainly encouraged people to think more about innovation and doing things differently. And I think we have to really take advantage of it to look and think about how we change healthcare the way other industries have been changed. And I love seeing, again, doctors, nurses, providers helping move that way.
Wonderful. I really enjoy listening to your vision. I so appreciate your leadership, your creativity, and the way you really translate that into some very practical strategies. Thank you for the conversation today.
Well, listen, thank you, Sandy. Appreciate the great questions and the focus on making lives easier for doctors.